It's a nice day for a white wedding. It's a nice day to start again. And it's also a nice day for Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. I'm Paul McInnes, and incoming on this week's emission, we'll discuss bald facts with Britpop survivor Skin of Skunk Anansie. Only crazy names are welcome in Singles Club as we review new music from Darwin Dees, Jukebox and Lindstrom. We'll have the best of you, and we'll be returning to Rosie Swash's youth as she remembers Bone Thugs and Harmony. But first, we're going to meet Ellie Goulding. That was Under the Sheets by Ellie Goulding, our first guest this week. When appearing on the pod a few weeks ago, Paul Lester, aka Mr. New Band of the Day, informed us that Goulding is an act upon whom great expectations are being placed in 2010. You could see Goulding as a continuation of this year's female electro poppers, LaRue, Little Boots, et al., with her delicate, distinctive vocals paired with dance floor friendly rhythms from producer Star Smith, aka Finn Dow Smith. It's pop music with a degree of sophistication, and so when Ellie came into the pod, we started with the sound, and I asked her to describe her own voice.
I've listened to so many singers, and I used to imitate singers, and I used to do covers all the time. I never used to do my own songs. And when I did start doing my own songs, they sounded bizarre because I had all these different influences. So now it's kind of a great big... What is the word when it's just everything just... It's kind of a big mix-up of lots of different things.
A mélange, the French might
yes,
say.
Well, it sounds sophisticated. Well, there we go. I'll try and use that in future. but it's kind of a mixture of all the different singers, and so it's kind of, it ranges from sort of R&B and even gospel-y stuff. You know, like Antonia Johnson's kind of really... hard to describe, I guess.
There's definitely a strength in your voice, but there's also a fragility to it as well, which is it makes for an interesting kind of combination.
I can definitely go for it when I want to, depending on what I'm singing. If there's something that I'm particularly... Something that's particularly emotive to me, I will really... I've got the lungs to just, you know, power it. But also, I've listened to a lot of singers in my lifetime that just have this kind of this really sweet kind of. I used to like a lot of folky singers who seem to be able to get across what they want to in the song without having to, you know, really bash it out. They can just sing something very sweet and melodic, and so I kind of have a mixture of that really.
The music, the tracks, I suppose, as exemplified by Under the Sheets, perhaps most clearly, is a mixture of a more singer-songwritery vocal and this poppy, and almost kind of some of it goes into dance, you know, electro dance kind of areas. And how did that mixture come about? Is that coming from you? Is it coming from Star Smith? How does that work?
Well, Star Smith was kind of a sort of blessing, really, when I met him, because I grew up initially when I was, I don't know, like 7 or 8, my mum and uncle hung out quite a lot because they loved the same music, dance music. I think it was a kind of escapism, really, because my uncle was in the army and stuff, and they listened to a lot of, like, you know, like training kind of music and sort of quite heavy, fast stuff. And then my mum, she sort of used to be really into punk music, I think, when she was younger, like Susie and the Banshees and stuff like that. So she was a real rebel. But then I think that it was kind of, she kind of completely rebelled on that whole punk thing and sort of went mainstream. And then it was from her and my uncle that I was just constantly listening to dance music all the time, you know, with big catchy choruses and big hooks.
So we're talking
and,
like proper
proper like euphoria kind of, like, you know, Judge Jaws kind of thing, like, right, all the time, like, you know, it sounds
big
weird
room music.
But just I picked up on how strong they were and how they made you feel, and you know, you see, like, I don't know, like when you see like a documentary or something or a TV program, and you just see all these ravers like in Ibiza, and just this euphoric thing with dance music. And I know not everyone feels it, but I had that kind of stored away in my head. And then as I was growing up, I obviously started getting into a lot more alternative stuff and rock and metal and electronic stuff. And it was Björk really who made me realise that you could still be a singer-songwriter and still add so many different elements to your music. You didn't have to just... Because I was just playing guitar, so it was just writing a song on guitar, and that was that. And I was kind of racking my brains as to who I could help... Who could help me to create this kind of music. And it wasn't like I wasn't like every day like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? I can't seem to express myself in the right way. But then I met Finn, and it was just, we made a song together, and it just, everything seemed to work. And he grew up on the same stuff as me, so he understands without us even having to discuss it, you know, in length about what I want my sound to be. We just kind of do it and get on with it.
Are you wary at this point in time, you know, lots of these 2010 lists are popping up now and your name invariably features on them. Are you wary about being hyped?
Yes. I don't like being hyped that much, because I don't think there's any point. It's just like, I don't really like shoving things down people's throats. I really don't want to force people to like me, and I don't want to force people to listen to my music.
Can you have any control over that?
Definitely. Like, if my manager, for example, who I love more than anything, like, he's been amazing.
And he discovered you at university or something like that?
No, actually, I was discovered by previous management at university. They were just people who spotted me in the crowd, and then we kind of worked together for like a year, and nothing sort of really blossomed. So I decided to look elsewhere, and I found Jamie. And similarly to Finn, it all just slotted into place with Jamie and Finn, who's Starsmith. Like, if for example he says, can you let everyone know that your single's out on Twitter or something, and I'm like, no, I don't want to do it, just because I don't want to seem like I'm just going, come on guys, buy my single, because I think that people will buy it if they want to, and people will listen if they want to. And you know, I come from Hereford, which is a place where it's not, you know, it's not, people don't even know what a blog is. I mean, not in a kind of patronising way, but like, why would they? You know, they buy a CD or listen to the radio or whatever, and that's how I think it should be, and that's how, what you should always consider, and you shouldn't consider all the kind of blogs in London and all the kind of scenes and everything. So I kind of think of it that way, and I think because I'm from somewhere like Hereford and it's pretty like sort of modest on the music front or whatever, I've kind of got that mentality where I don't even think about stuff like hype and lists and things like that, because it's all about just making music that people, for example, people from places like Hereford will just listen to on the radio and buy. Mm-hmm. Simple as that.
You've moved to London. It must be, obviously it's a very different experience. Do you find it stimulating to be in a big city when you're making music?
It definitely has broadened my view of everything, like in music. It's I've realised there's a whole different world with music. So I've kind of seen both worlds. I've seen where I just go down to open mic nights and play, and people enjoy it, and you know, they want to listen to you more. But then London, it's almost like I find London really overwhelming, because I've come straight from a village to like another, like a small town in Canterbury at university, and then I moved to London, and it is quite a kind of everything's a lot more pressure, definitely, because you're not only being judged just by your music as someone would hear it, but also on everything else, like just, you know, people talking about you on blogs and people, I don't know,
and where you're picking
up on the hype. Exactly, yeah. And
what kind of hats you wear?
Well, yes, I do wear this hat. I do actually wear this hat every day. It's become sort of a trademark of mine. But Yeah, it's definitely a different scene being in London, right in the centre of it. And I mean, for example, I don't really go out partying that much. I'm a bit boring, really. So I don't think I would. I mean, I might be saying this now and then. In like a few months, you'll see me falling out of a club or something.
Is Sarah Harding on your arm?
Oh God. Well, I don't know about that. Maybe Cheryl Cole. I think that would be
a bit
that would
be a good sort girls of,
well, yeah, and you know, she's a good person to be seen with at the moment, apparently.
Yeah, so
but yeah, it is. It's definitely very different from where I come from. It's a completely different world.
That's Ellie Goulding. Under the Sheets is out now on Neon Gold Records, and we will have an exclusive live acoustic track later in the show. Next to me, wearing a lovely light yellow cardigan.
Oh, thanks.
Is that made of a special material?
I think it's synthetic.
Synthetic. from a synthetic sheep. Turning to my right. Is my right? Yes, it is. I have in front of me, and I have the pleasure of introducing Mr. Michael Han.
Good afternoon, Paul. Good afternoon, Rosie.
You've come in to join us on Singles Club today. Thank you very much for that.
Always a pleasure.
We'll start with your choice, and that's Darwin Dees with Constellations. Are there patterns in our skies? Are patterns only in our eyes? Or is the constellation? That was Constellations by Darwin Dees. Darwin Dees hails from New York, of course, and has a distinctive fashion style that can only be described as like a tramp going to the gym. Darwin also likes to tap dance, and this combination naturally makes him one of the hottest things in pop right now. Constellations is his debut single.
I picked it up, Paul, with a sense of trepidation because he's got very silly hair. I thought this is going to be dreadful, isn't it? And I put it on and I was delighted. Absolutely delighted. I think it's a lovely song. It's got some of the same things going for it that Julian Casablancas' solo record does, but I think so much more concise. Actually, it's much more likeable. And where Julian Casablancas' songs drag on for 6.5 minutes, you got bored of the hook by the time it gets to the end. You're not allowed the chance to get fed up of this. It's got that same sense of ennui in the vocal, but it's made this absolutely charming pop melody, I think. It's as if the Strokes had come out, instead of trying to play New York punk, they've been trying to play new wave pop. I mean, it doesn't sound like there's anything trying to be cool about it. I mean, there's a real sense of wide-eyed openness. I think Constellations is a really fitting title. It does feel like someone gazing at the stars for all the sadness in his voice.
That pretty much sums it up for me, I think. I mean, the melody is quite Strokesy,
oh,
even though it's kind of got the punk edge taken out. It does stay in the head, doesn't it?
It does. I have to say, when I first listened to it, I thought, God, this is actually pulling off something which so few songs of this kind do, which is it's incredibly jolly without being kitsch or saccharine or glit. Like, it hasn't got any of that edge to it. It's just a bit too much. So it is, like you said, concise is a really good word for what it pulls off. But my only complaint would be I found it a little bit lacking in kind of groove, even though it sort of appears to possess it. There was something lacking in that area for me.
I mean, the first time I listened to it, I thought it sounded like a chart pop record. And I listened more, I was in the car, and I listened to it more closely at home, and clearly it's not. Clearly it is actually quite a ramshackle indie record that's just got enough of a kind of veneer of classiness about it to enable it to cross over.
My one thing about it, I think, is that I wasn't sure whether it was wry in its tone or just a little simples. Mm-hmm. There is the lyrics, which I think are kind of quite repetitive on the starry theme and a little imagistic, but not particularly insightful, also contain lines like, if freckles don't mean anything, does anything mean anything? And I'm not sure that could be incredibly profound, or it could be slightly tongue-in-cheek, or it could just be nonsense. That is Darwin D's and Constellations, and it is coming up soon on Lucky Star Records. So soon, in fact, it's out on December the 7th. Next up on Singles Club is Phantom Don't Go by Jukebox. That was Jukebox with Phantom Don't Go. Jukebox is really David Adamson, who cites influences in his music as diverse as Appalachian folk and deep house. So if you see any hillbillies having it to David Morales, chances are they're Jukebox fans. Rosie.
Yes, this is mine, isn't it?
Yes, it is your
choice. Defend it now.
No, not necessarily. You can kind of go out there.
Well, I did have my
enthused.
Okay, I will. I did have my reservations about picking this because there's something about it and something about Jukebox which feels so inherently naff, and I can't put my finger on it at all. I think it's the album that this is taken from has got this kind of monster motif running through it, the phantoms and the zombies, and it, you know, it's a bit boyish, and it kind of just that just doesn't speak to me at all. But also the name Dead Zone Boys, which is the name of the album, is just like some horrible donk collective or something like that. So I guess my prejudices are very shallow. But there's something about this song that I just, when I'm listening to it, it's not even that I'm necessarily enjoying it. I'm just so intrigued by all the sounds. I think it's got those two refrains that you just heard in that clip, the Phantom Don't Go, and then Dead Zone Boys Have Come to Take Your Life Away. I just, like, instantly just lodge somewhere in your brain. And I love the sort of cacophony, horrible word for a music journalist to use, but I love the cacophony of noises in it. I don't know how you classify something like this. I guess maybe that's kind of what put me off at first. Sometimes when you don't know which box to put something in, it can almost seem unappealing. And now I think that's one of its traits as an album, and this is as a song particularly. I just don't really know where it sits or even where it comes from. I know David Adamson says he, you know, was a hip hop aficionado in his youth, and I think you can kind of hear that, but apart from anything else, it's quite weird and it intrigues me, and that's what I like.
I think that's one of its strongest suits though, isn't it?
Well, you can't put it in
it. Yeah, you can't classify it. And I think that it does bring something new to the table. I mean, I picked up, it sounds lots of Queens of the Stone Age elements in there for me, particularly the kind of the guitar sounds and the drums, and or maybe even something borderline musy in the pace of it.
What's interesting that what you heard was guitars as well, even though it's not a guitar track, cause that's exactly what I heard, but what it reminded me of was kind of really sludgy groups like the Melvins. Yeah, it clearly doesn't have a lot in common with them. It's got that same sense of lurching through the song. You know, it's like a juggernaut that can't quite stop. It's travelling slowly, but it can't stop. I see why it's intriguing, but it just feels too sludgy. It's like wading through treacle to me.
That is Phantom Don't Go by Jukebox, and it's available now on the album Dead Zone Boys, which is out on Asthmatic Kitty Records. Final track on Singles Club is Lindstrom with his version of Little Drummer Boy. That was Lindstrom's Little Drummer Boy. Hans-Peter Lindstrom is a producer whose music is often described as cosmic disco and less often as space house. It is unknown whether this music is popular with Appalachians. This is a cover of the Christmas classic Little Drummer Boy, as performed most notably by Bing Crosby and David Bowie. Sorry, did I say classic? I meant atrocity. This is my choice. I'm trying to do like a public good here by teeing up a choice that people could play at their Christmas party this year, particularly if they plan on spiking the punch. It sounds to me a little bit like something that they might play were Greenland ever to have a space program and they were to launch a rocket for Mars. It conjured up a very different view of a track that everybody knows, and I think it does it tongue-in-cheek. But it's also a sound that I've been getting quite into this year, particularly when I was in Berlin, listening to a lot of minimal techno and these dragged-out, kind of almost drugged synthesizer sounds that can go on for 8 minutes. And I think it hints at a cosmic universe where everything can be that slow and that vocodery. And I like it for that. Michael?
Well, I've only heard the 5 minutes. I'd like to hear the full 40.
There is a 40-minute version of this track, yes, it is true.
Which could well be a floor clearer at your Christmas party. Who knows? I like this. There's something about the little drummer boy that really lends itself to drones. Now, the Dandy Warhols did a version about 10, 12 years ago as a kind of guitar drone, a psychedelic guitar drone. Low did a version on their Christmas EP, when's that, about 10 years ago, 9, 10 years ago. That's very similar to this, you know, this just glacial wall of synthesizers over the top of which comes a melody. And the Lindstrom track almost sounds like a remix of the Low track. It's doing the same thing. But yeah, if you sink into this intense drone, I mean, it just carries you away. I think, for all the cheesiness of the melody, I find I'm a big Christmas fan, and I get very annoyed with people who say that Christmas is rubbish. Christmas is great, and there is a place for devotional music at Christmas. It shouldn't just all be, I wish it could be Christmas every day and Merry Christmas everybody. I love listening to new treatments of carols especially. And this fits, it ticks a lot of Christmas boxes
for
me.
Yeah, and it's kind of, it's a song that falls halfway between devotional and consumer though, doesn't it?
I agree with Michael. I love Christmas. Hear, hear. I hate people that put it down. And I think that this works for you. If you love Christmas, what's brilliant about this is you don't need the lyrics. And actually, you know, most carols are biblical in nature, and that doesn't suit everybody anyway, and it doesn't really relate to most people's Christmas anymore. And so what this does, in a weird way, minimal techno completely suits it, because minimal techno is all about evocative sounds and atmosphere, and really that's what Christmas songs do. They remind you of something, they provoke nostalgia, provoke feeling in you, and they conjure up an atmosphere of a time of year, so it completely works. And in a way that I just don't really feel anything. You know, Julian Casablancas has got this, God, we keep talking about the Strokes, Julian Casablancas, but he's got this version of I Wish It Was Christmas Today out, which is a Saturday Night Live song, so it's already a piss take, and he's done this like Sleigh Bells and All version, and you just think, what's the point? It doesn't work at all. Whereas this is just lovely, and it sounds great, and it conjures up something. It really works. So basically, now what we need is Fever Ray's version of Little Donkey, and we'll be laughing.
Well said, Rosie Swash. The 4-minute edit of Lindstrom is available to download now in several places, Pitchfork amongst them. On the blog last week, we had SV80 talking about Solange Knowles' version of Stillness Is the Move. I'm not a huge fan of the Dirty Projectors, but their version of Stillness Is the Move captivated me instantly. It's a perfect homage to Timbaland, Aaliyah, and the inventive territory they explored. Smoothing out the strange contours and replacing them with a fairly standard R&B backing can't capture the same magic. Okay, we want your reviews of this week's tracks, Lindstrom, Jukebox and Darwin D's, on our blog at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Tell us what you think of Darwin D's tracks and these others that are out this week. Thank you very much, Michael Hann.
And thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed the music this week. Even Rosie's, I enjoyed the experience of exploring it.
That's right. It's all about the journey,
so
isn't it, with us?
This week.
Yeah, I know. It's because we're bearing in on Christmas.
Yeah.
Either that or we just want to keep our jobs. Sure. One of the two. All right, that's it for this week's Singles Club. Now it's time for our second guest this week. Hands up, who remembers this? That's Week by Skunk and Nancy, featuring the unmistakable vocals of Skin, our second guest this week. Band who were often lumped in as part of Britpop, Skunk and Nancy had a far punkier sound, and a different agenda, did they not, Rosie?
Indeed, but you know what us music journalists are like. We like to lump everything together.
It so just makes it easier, so you can stick it all on the same shelf.
Exactly. They did exist at the same time of the Pulps and the Oasis and the Blurs of this world, but of course they sounded completely different. And one of the reasons I got really into them when I was young is because they just didn't sound like anything else that existed. This incredibly angry, vocal woman, you know, screaming about all sorts of angsty things. They obviously took their cues from, you know, American hardcore much more than they did from anything from this side of the pond, and they were hugely successful on both sides of the pond. And then they split up in 2001, and now they've got back together for a greatest hits. So I got Skin into the studio to reminisce about that time, and here she is explaining why now is the right time for them to get back together.
Well, it all started because of One Little Indian, because they wanted to do greatest hits. Oh, okay. And they've been bugging us about the last 4 years to do it. But you have to kind of, everybody has to be free at the same point at the same time of the year, and that just wasn't possible, you know, because of Mark's in Fido and I was doing solo albums. And then this year, it was the same story, but Lee, our manager, was very kind of, okay, you have to meet and you have to do this, you know, because otherwise you're going to miss the time to do it. And we just met up, and that was really the catalyst for everything else, because we were, once all four of us had been in the same room at the same time, which was the first time in 9 years that we'd all four of us been at the same time. There was three and there was two, but not four. We just kind of fell back into being a band. It was really easy, very natural, very comfortable. We have all the special archive stuff. We have in our own collections all the best stuff to do a greatest hit. So we kind of took it off the record company and just did it ourselves. Weak as I am, no tears for you. Weak as I am, no tears for you. Deep as I.
So you split up in 2001. Mm-hmm. It wasn't acrimonious then. It was more.
No, I think it was two things. I think we were worn out, you know, very very tired, and as a consequence, needed a good old break. I think that the chemistry and the spirit and the vibe of the band became quite disconnected and dissipated, and the bottom fell out of the band. You know, everybody was in their own worlds doing different things, making bad decisions all at the same time. And I think we just stopped it before we made two really bad albums and, you know, started going out with page three footballers' wives that, you know, sold our stories to the Hackney Gazette or something, you know.
We were talking about the kind of music that Skunk and Nancy made and still makes, which is very distinctive and was kind of nothing like anything else that was in the charts or doing well, and yet you kind of got lumped into the whole Britpop.
Well, it's funny because in hindsight we do, but we weren't at the time.
Oh, right. Okay.
We were really not part of it, and we were complete outsiders. And that's what the whole clip rock thing started.
Right.
Because I was taking a piss, because we couldn't get on TV, the same TV shows. We didn't get radio play. We didn't get any of the things that a band of our size was getting, because we weren't Britpop enough and we weren't Britrock. And we were actively told this by our radio people and by our record companies. Mm. But we were doing really well anyway, but in hindsight, you know, everyone thinks, oh yeah, Skunk and Nancy, Blur, Oasis, Echo Belly.
They were on the same Select compilation.
It's kind of like, oh no, we weren't part of that. Yeah. We weren't allowed at the time, and in hindsight, history has changed that view. Mm. But it was really frustrating. I've never been quite frustrated by it at the time, because we weren't given the same respect and the same. We were just too different. We were very different from the whole Britpop thing.
Mm.
And I think it was just easier for bands at the time to jump into it and jump into that pool. So they just kind of, you know, wore the same clothes, had the same sound.
I was going through the clippings in preparation for this interview, and there was an interview that you gave to this newspaper, actually, in 1996. And I can quote the writer saying, she's still out there on her own now, a black woman playing white rock, a lesbian in a hetero business. which sounds kind of bleak, but it's also, I guess, what...
Oh, times have changed.
I don't know if
you still
now.
Get that sentence now.
Yeah.
Without me, but It was very interesting because it was very people just talked about sexuality and race all the time. And I'm really happy to see that's just not so much the case now. Mm. You know, there's so many black people in bands, so many gay people in bands and bisexual people in bands, stuff like that. It's not such a big issue. I mean, I got, you know, in those days it was a bit of a, you know, you were tarred and feathered. Mm. I think now it's not so negative.
You were very open and almost immediately about your sexuality, but you still have, I mean, it's, you know, I'm obviously not going to name names, but there are still people who are privately gay, and it's a sort of open secret, but would never want to go on record with it.
Yeah.
Do you, I mean, I kind of, it's totally a personal decision in that regard.
Well, do you know, I think that because I kind of got in, you know, before Skunk Anansie, I was in the band with Cass, so that was when early 20s. Mm. So by the time Skunk Anansie got signed, I was 26. So I think I was quite an adult at that point. You know, I'd been through all the lots of issues. I'd gotten over various things in my childhood. I'd was very okay with my bisexuality. You know, my parents knew, my friends knew, you know. There was no reason to hide, you know. I was completely unaware of how the public would deal with it. But I was strong enough. I was very strong. I had a very good support network. I had lots of friends. I had my life. I had my society. I had my circle of friends that we all call, and I just didn't have the isms and schisms and the weight from other people. It was quite a shock to discover a lot of negativity once, you know. It was an NME interview, I think, and they said, oh, so what does your boyfriend think about your music? I said, oh, well, actually, my girlfriend. I think they were fishing.
Right,
now okay. I look at it now, but I was very naive, naively just thought,
yeah, Hillary Clinton,
oh, my girlfriend, you know, and I was just like, you know, whatever, you know, and then that was the headline, you know,
right.
And that was the headlines from that point on were, you know, bisexual, yeah. Lesbian, blah, 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 lead singer, bald bisexual, black fronted lead singer of Skunk Anansie.
She ticks all the boxes.
Yeah, you know, it's talk about, you know, talk about which one I'm going to have a chip on my shoulder with first, then. I saw a weird boy. He looked at me with a look of pure hate. Nobody knew all the grief where he'd been. He was a sad boy. He was a victim of a dirty good time. Feely games in the back of his boarded up estate. Soon enough, he's picking on me. Kick my head in, cause that's all that it seems. Soon enough, he's picking on me. Picking on me.
I also always wanted to ask, because I was, as I said, you know, really liked Stush. That was the real coming of age album for me, and I used to listen to Picking on Me on loop. So obviously that would speak to the self-pitying teenager in all of us. So I just wanted to know whether there was a particular thing that inspired that Picking on Me, or whether it was just, you know, because it's a sad song.
It was
about being,
do you know, brilliant. What it was, yeah, but it was a song that was actually, I mean, I know why people think it's about being bullied, but it's actually a song about, if you don't look after that person, they're going to be picking on you.
Right.
You know, because it's all about, I crushed his head and I did this, I did this, and then soon enough they're picking on me. And it's just that mentality of, you know, if you don't stick up for other people's rights, you know, whether you're gay or not, if you don't stick up for gay people's rights, if you don't stick up for black people's rights, if you're gay, or if you don't stick up for old people's rights, or, you know, this or that, you know, they always, you know, you let them get that, you know, it's like Hitler letting them, everybody's, oh, we're giving Poland. And what did he do?
BMP, let them on news.
You know, then they come for everybody else. You know, we can all be picked on because we've all got things that people don't like about us. That's why we've got to stick up for each other, because we do have that innate desire to be top and to kill everybody off. So, you know, because they're white, or because, you know, they've got different kind of hair. You know, you look in magazines and see how particular you are about very detailed things about people's appearance. So I just think that my very long-winded way of saying it is, like, you know, we have to be careful because we do have that tendency to hate ourselves.
That was Skin from Skunk Anansie, and their greatest hits album, Smashes and Traces, is available now on One Little Indian.
Thanks a lot, Rosie. And it's you again now, because it's the feature with no name. And it's you looking back on those harmonising hip-hoppers from Ohio, Bones, Thugs and Harmony. And I'll spare you your blushes and introduce it for you.
Boom, 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 boom. Now tell me what you're gonna do, but it ain't nowhere to run. When judgment comes for you, when judgment comes for you. Tell me what you're gonna do, when it ain't nowhere to hide. When judgment comes for you, cause it's gonna come for you.
Dance off, swinging it for water. Easy, see something jolly. Little boo boo guys got it. And I'm gonna miss everybody out of road.
Every so often, a band or artist comes along with a sound which totally blows you away. You can probably trace the roots and influences of the music, but it still sounds unique and unexpected. I first heard Bone Thugs and Harmony when their song The Crossroads went to number one in the UK chart in 1995. It was like nothing I'd ever heard before, and being a 13-year-old white girl from North London, Midwest gangster rap naturally struck a chord with me. The name Bone Thugs and Harmony said it all. The group consisted of four, and later five, thuggish MCs who incorporated melody into their rapping and offered up half-sung, half-rapped harmonies in quick-time delivery. They formed in Cleveland, Ohio in 1991 and caught the ear of NWA's Eazy-E, who went on to produce their critically acclaimed album E1999 Eternal, his last notable project before his untimely death at 31 of an AIDS-related illness. Despite having previously established themselves with typically banal, violent lyrics, the album represented a subtle but vital shift away from plain aggression. First of the Month detailed the problems in trying to be a profitably successful gangster while also being a dedicated weed smoker, while Bud Smokers Only concentrated solely on the joys of the latter. Though it was a dedication I admired, their commitment to marijuana wasn't really what interested me. It was the baffling, entrancing delivery and the pure naughtiness of the production. It sounded brilliant. Their next album, The Art of War, continued the group's chart-topping success and went 4x platinum. The group earned their place on several top 10 hip-hop groups of all time lists and finally committed every rapper's desired rite of passage when they sampled a Phil Collins song for 2001's Home, even getting the singer to contribute fresh vocals to the track. But the group tailed off during the 2000s, during which time Flesh and Bone was sentenced to 11 years in prison for assault. Fellow rapper Busy Bone became homeless after appearing on America's Most Wanted to talk about being sexually and physically abused as a child. He resurfaced on a Houston radio show where he reportedly spoke in tongues and constantly praised God. And yet the quintet were all back in the studio last year upon Flesh and Bone's release from prison to record their most recent album, The World's Enemy. They also completed what appears to be a brand new rite of passage for most rappers by offering up their own version of Jay-Z's Death of Altitude. What becomes of the group from now on is unclear, though they're unlikely to rekindle the chart success of the 90s. What's pretty much indisputable, however, is that their unique sound has imprinted itself on the world of hip-hop and their legacy is assured.
Bringing these bills to my house. Quit bringing this stress to my spouse. Cause I'm ready for the kill on. Look out, look out. If you trying to run up on the bone, I'ma show you like this. I'ma pull my chrome. I don't wanna have to send it home. Lord, please take me home. Come and take me home.
That was Rosie on Bones, Thugs and Harmony. Just time for a little bit of you, a little bit of face back. We've got Aaron Graff on the blog.
And he or she is saying, I love Morphine, which is obviously last week's feature with no name. Brilliant bass lines, great vocals, top class, top floor, bottom buzzer is one of my favourite ever songs.
I wonder if on the blog when people are using pseudonyms, they should kind of put an M or an F in brackets to signify gender.
That is an excellent idea.
Hey, thanks very much. I'm sure nobody will do it. But anyway, elsewhere on the blog, Jeff Liu waded in to correct an erroneous, a massive error on last week's podcast. Not that I'm a huge defender of the Twilight series, no, of course you're not, but I think your patronising view that the changing of the seasons while the Likey Lie song played in the film showed a loss in confidence from the filmmakers is surely only due to not having read the books yourselves. This is, of course, a main issue with the critics who try to pick apart the film, because obviously you can't criticise a film unless you've read the books, Rosie. Bear that in mind for future when you're watching Anna Karenina, the movie. In fact, the inclusion of the words to represent the months are probably more to do with the empty chapters in the book, where the passing of time was only marked by headings with empty pages, the name of each month as it passed.
I know I speak on behalf of Rebecca Nicholson when I say life must be hard going through it with no sense of humour.
Rosie, you can be so
lighten
tough.
Up.
You can be so tough sometimes. Okay, post some more comments on this week's blogs. Make them really vituperative and then Rosie will give you a kicking on the pod. That, however, is all from Rosie and I on this week's pod. It's been great, Rosie.
It has indeed.
It's been fantastic. We're going to leave you now with an exclusive live acoustic track from Ellie Goulding. This is Guns and Horses.
You're so quiet, but it doesn't faze me. You're on time. You move so fast, makes me feel lazy. Let's join forces. We've got our guns and horses. I know you've been burned, but every fire is a lesson learned. I left my house, left my clothes. Door wide open, heaven knows. Oh, you're so worth it. You are. But I wish I could feel it all for you. I wish I could be it all for you. If I could erase the pain. I would. Whoa. Let's tie words. Oh, 'cause they amount to nothing. Play it down. Pretend you can't take what you found. But you found me on a screen. You sit out permanently. I left my house, left my clothes. Door wide open, heaven knows. You're so worth it. You are. Ooh. But I wish I could feel it all for you. I wish I could be it all for you. If I could erase. It's time to come clean and make sense of everything. It's time that we found out who we are. 'Cause when I'm standing here in the dark, I see your face in every star. Ooh. Oh, but I wish I could feel it all. I could be it all, I'll be all for you, if I could erase the pain, maybe you'd feel the same, I'd do it all for you, I would, I'd do it all for you, 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 I'd do it all for you.